Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Today we have Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston back in the studio with me today. Lisa, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Brian, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, finally known as Dr. Death. How is your garden doing this season? Are you having problems with diseases or pests? What other gardening questions might you have as well? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas at WPR.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And Brian, good to see you back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And Lisa, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll start with Brian and just, you know.
I'm happy as a clam, Larry, I have to say.
You're getting lots of business. You're getting lots of business, lots of plant diseases out there. What are you seeing?
Definitely lots of anthracnose on maples. That's probably been our biggest seller this year or so far. Mm-hmm. A lot of problems with conifers. With winter injury coming out of the rather weird winter that we had this past year. Also a lot of needle cast diseases on things like spruce. It's just been wonderful. I was quite excited with an email photo I got yesterday, a disease that I don't normally see, a rust disease that causes brooming, so clusters of branches in spruce trees. And it was so well taken, I could actually see the sporulation on the needles, which was really cool.
Really cool.
Very cool.
Well, Lisa, what about you? What about insects? You seeing any pest population problems yet that come across your desk?
Well, I identified my first bed bug this season. That was exciting. And yesterday, this is really cool. Last week, actually, I got to identify a jumping worm by the bristles that are on the segments. And it turned out it was not a jumping worm, but I had to go through this key of these different bristle patterns, stick the thing under the microscope, and, you know, hope it wouldn't wiggle too much, and look at the bristle pattern. So it was very cool.
But nothing yet that's attacking vegetables or flowers very much, pest-wise?
We have had some problems. There's some kind of fly that lays eggs. It's a leaf miner on Swiss chard. Been seeing some of that. Mine got hit. There's also, there was some frost damage on real early crops and that kind of thing. But not too much yet. I'm expecting things to start hitting the fan any time now.
Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is of pretty much full. So let's go to the phones. And Rita in Wausau, you're up. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Is this for Rita?
Yes, Rita. Okay.
Anyway, I'm mystified by my rhubarb patch. I went down for my first picking, and it was many of the stalks were flowering, and those were hollow. And I just wonder what I did wrong last fall and what I should avoid doing so I don't have that same problem next year.
Hmm. Is this an established plant or was it newly?
Yes, about 4 years.
I suspect you didn't probably do anything wrong. It's probably weather related would be my guess. Maybe because did you have really hot weather really early?
Well, in April, we had 20 inches of snow. Now, let me go back and try to think. Yes, we did have some hot weather.
Yeah. I'm wondering if that, I don't remember whether rhubarb is, it must not be daylight regulated.
Yeah, all I know is that Amanda Gibbons, our vegetable pathologist in the plant pathology department, recently commented that in terms of growing degree days, we're about 20 days ahead.
Yeah, so, which is weird because we started out so far
really
behind,
slow.
But then we got that really hot spell, which is what I was wondering if you got as well. And that, I noticed that too. I was looking at the pest bulletin report and
So it could be just a matter that they just developed very, very rapidly and you're seeing what you would normally see in July.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Thanks a lot for calling, Rita. Let's go to Stacy in West Salem next. Hi, Stacy.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have have a question. I have a wonderful raspberry patch, and for the past couple of years, the Japanese beetles, the iridescent ones, have really wreaked havoc on it. And they're not around yet, obviously, but is there anything I can do now to keep them away?
Not well, a lot, is there?
No. I wish there was. Can't remember whether it was last year or the year before when it was like, yeah, every other time I picked up the phone, it was a Japanese beetle question because they were just really having a good year. And unfortunately, with the Japanese beetles, because you have both the grub issue, which, you know, the grubs develop into the beetles, and then you have the adult issue, it's really hard to control because the grubs are going to be in your lawn, in your neighbor's lawn. If you happen to live near a golf course, good luck, because that's really where they like to be, well cared for, well watered, well fertilized turf. So even if you were to treat your lawn to eliminate some of the grubs, unless your neighbors and your neighbor's neighbors and their neighbors did it,
for at least a half a mile away.
Yeah, right, because they're pretty good flyers. It's just very hard. And then the adults, as you've noted, take they take up much of the season. They're usually here, at least in the Madison area, from about the 23rd, 25th of June, and then they leave around the second week or so in September. So that's a really long time to try and control them.
How big is your garden?
That's
patch?
Another question.
How big is my garden?
Your raspberry patch.
Oh, it's considerable. I mean, I have to. I would say probably
10 by 10
by 20 feet.
20 by 20. Okay.
Yeah, if it were small, you could consider actually putting up some screening, and commercial growers do that. You can also, there are some sprays. Neem oil can be effective, but it's just really hard with a very soft fruit like raspberries. It's easy to damage it, and of course you don't want to be constantly spraying. So all this works out to one single sentence: I don't really have a good option for
right.
you.
Yeah. And if the Japanese beetles don't take them out, probably the spotted winged Drosophila will.
Oh,
anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's even worse because they're so tiny. And at least with the Japanese beetles, you could potentially screen, but with the Drosophila, not really an option.
Yeah. So we don't have a lot of help for you there, Stacy. Unfortunately.
No. That's okay. It's an answer, right?
Not the one you wanted.
No.
Not the one you wanted. And, you know, sometimes those populations expand, and then suddenly they drop back. They crash. So let's hope for a crash this year, Stacy. Thanks a lot for calling.
You know, there might be, because we did have that very cold snap unexpectedly without a lot of snow. So maybe we can
help.
That
would help a little bit anyway. Yeah, thanks again. Let's go to Dan in West Bend. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I planted beets about 4 weeks ago, and they were about 6 inches tall. I've been thinning them and weeding them. And I went out 3 days ago, and it looked like something had cut them off all right to the base.
Ugh.
I wonder what would cause that.
If it was earlier in their development, I'd say cutworms, but it could be chipmunks or rabbits.
Rabbits or chipmunks, yeah.
Is it a clean cut?
I have the garden fenced in, but...
Could be voles, too.
Yeah. Some of the smaller rabbits, I know my dad tries to fence off rabbits, but when they're very tiny, sometimes they can get in.
Yeah, I've got one in my yard. It's too small to trip the trap, but not too small to eat all my most expensive plants.
Yeah, I would still watch out for small animals because I think that's likely.
Yeah, I think that's where you're at, Dan. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Layla in Green Bay, your turn.
Hi. I just have a question about what I can plant by a black walnut tree. I've done some research, and I'm not finding any information on two specific things that I want planted. I want to plant a fine-line buckthorn shrub, and I also want to plant a mountain ash tree, European or American. And I'm just not finding information if they'll do well by a black walnut.
Okay. Well, first of all, we don't really recommend fine line buckthorn, even though it is touted as not producing viable seed, according to our woody plant ornamental specialist. It does, so she doesn't like to use it.
It has some disease problems, too.
Yeah, that's the other thing. And mountain ash typically is fairly short-lived because of diseases that Brian can tell you all about.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether that does well. We do have a great fact sheet that Brian put together about plants that will grow under black walnut. There are a number of shrubs as well.
Right. If you go to my website, my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu, and in the main menu, one of the tabs says fact sheets. Hover over that, select all out of the drop-down menu, and then look for black walnut toxicity. And on the back side of that fact sheet, we have a list of our best guess of things that are either sensitive or tolerant to the toxins that are produced by black walnut. Keep in mind that take that with a grain of salt, because there hasn't been a lot of formal testing of plants. So a lot of this is based on anecdotal information. So people trying to grow things around a walnut tree, and they say either it works or it doesn't. And sometimes that can mislead you. But again, I wouldn't recommend fine line buckthorn, quite frankly, because it gets what's called crown rust. It's a fungal disease that alternates between buckthorn and an urban area's turf, quite frankly. And what you'll get are large kind of yellowish masses that'll form on the leaves and the green stems and cause a lot of growth distortions. Makes the plant look pretty unattractive. And again, Laura Joel, our woody ornamental specialist, doesn't recommend that. And mountain ash, again, I don't recommend that particular tree just because it tends to get a lot of apple scab, which is a leaf disease. That's the one that oftentimes will defoliate crab apples. And then they tend to be very prone to root rot problems. So unless you have a very well-drained site, I would not plant that tree. And I usually don't expect them to survive more than about 15 years, quite frankly.
Yeah, at the most.
So your site is pddc.wisc.edu?
That's correct.
So, Layla, I hope you can go to that site, and what do you do again? You hover over...
Go over the fact sheet tab. You'll get kind of a... You can get a selection. You can ask for vegetable fact sheets or whatever. I just tell folks, select all, and then you get an alphabetical listing, and it'll be under black walnut toxicity. And if you have any problems finding it, on the front page of my website, there's contact information where you can get a hold of me. I'm the editor on that series, so I can either send you a copy via email or however you'd like, or help you find it on the website.
There we go. Thanks, Layla. Appreciate the call. And let's go to Lisa in Amberg. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. I have a question, another question about rhubarb. I have a considerable patch of rhubarb. But what I'm finding is that the stalks are growing like crazy, but they're really skinny. Do I need to divide the plant, or is it something to do with fertility?
How old is it, do your plant?
It's probably four years old. That was since the last time I divided it.
If it's a considerable size patch, that was my first guess. That's probably what you need to do. It's crowding causing that. However, that being said, it still might be weather related unless you've been experiencing that for a couple years.
Okay, yeah. I would say it's probably overcrowded then. And I had a question about the website. Does the PD, B as in boy or D as in dog?
D as in dog. And it's two D's, and it stands for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. That's the name of my lab.
I thought it was plant database or something.
No. The other thing you can do is just do a web search on UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, and that should pop up as well.
I usually just tell people to do an internet search for PDDC and then UWEX, and that's
there it comes.
Simple too.
Yep. Thanks, Lisa, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Taking a look at your garden today, talking a bit about plant diseases and insects that could be a problem for you, but we're taking other general questions as well with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Sarah Hopeful, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. We are in the garden today with our two guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a full line, so we'll go to the phones right away again. Dominique in Black River Falls up next. Dominique? Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The in regards to the individual that's talking about the raspberry patch, I'm a landscaper in the Black River Falls area, and one product that we've had that has some success with in treating trees is a product called Zytec. And what we do is in the early spring, we do a soil injection. But I know also you can do a soil drench around, and I don't know what the specific, I haven't looked at the label for something specific like a raspberry shrub, but if it doesn't affect the fruit, she could maybe look at something like that because you wouldn't be doing a foliar spray and, you know, coating the fruit or constantly coating the plant. It's usually once a season that you are able to treat it, and then it's usually last throughout the growing season of the plant for the summer. And I thought I'd just call and let you know, see if she could maybe try that and see if that would work.
All right. Thanks, Dominique, for calling. Appreciate your call. The main problem with the Japanese beetles is that they can just fly in from anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I'd be more concerned in this particular case about usually a systemic product can
get into the fruit.
And I'm again, like he pointed out, we're not sure that it's labeled for that. But many times there are products that are not suitable for edible plants, but they do work really well on
lawns,
trees,
or
and
whatever.
Shrubs. Yeah.
There we go. Thanks again for calling. Danny in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been considering starting my own small garden at my home, and I had heard that there may be some mental health benefits to gardening, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. There are a number of studies out there that talk about mental health benefits, and not only just for one person, but when you have community gardens, it helps to reduce isolation and depression, and it helps to build community, and there's the physical exercise part of it. There's even been some studies that show that working with the soil, there is some kind of, I don't remember, it's, there's something about inhaling that, yeah, with the microorganisms that make you feel better, certainly being out in the sun, as long as you're wearing sunscreen, it is something that's been shown along those lines as well. There are multiple studies out there. I do remember also fairly recently that Sam Dennis from the UW Landscaping Department had written an article that was in one of the UW publications. It was about placemaking, but it also talked about those kinds of mental health benefits.
Yeah. Danny, were you thinking flowers or vegetables or both?
You know, I hadn't gotten that far yet.
All right. I just wondered, because if you're thinking about starting this year yet, there's still lots of things you could do.
Absolutely.
In a garden. Vegetables? What could we plant right now in the vegetable garden?
Assuming, Danny, are you building raised beds, or are you doing in-ground?
Yeah, I was thinking about raised beds. I saw that the pallets were a pretty easy option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could work. You're talking about a pallet garden where you plant into a wooden pallet?
Yeah, you plant into the pallet, and I believe you staple the fabric in there to keep the soil in place.
Right, okay. That's most suitable for smaller plants, so things like herbs can work well in there. Early in the season, things like lettuce, once it starts to get hot, it's a little bit harder to do that. But, yeah, some of the smaller herbs can work. Clearly, something like a tomato wouldn't be so good, but some of the smaller things can definitely work in that kind of setting.
Highly recommended, Danny. Thanks a lot for calling. Vegetables and flowers. Usually there's, if you've got a vegetable garden, you usually have a flower garden somewhere too.
Yeah.
My only recommendation would be to start small and work your way up so you don't feel overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Because
I think,
we see people that go gung-ho for gardening and then they totally get frustrated because they've gone too big.
Yeah. And you want to have some success first to build on and learn in a small way first before.
And we've got so many for Danny, probably not familiar with all the publications on growing in a vegetable garden and through extension through the Learning Store and so forth.
Yeah, the Learning Store, if you just use your internet search to say Learning Store and then UWEX, that will bring up the Learning Store and you click on Lawn and Garden and there is a search box and you can put specialized gardening or just the word specialized I think ought to bring up that publication that, you know, it talks about the raised beds and it talks about I think permaculture and some other specialized types of gardening that particularly work well. There's also a community garden series that does mention some things, vegetables that are easily grown. So those might bear looking at.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Danny. Good luck with that. Call us back in a couple of months and let us know how it's going, okay? Appreciate it. Well, Sue in Mequon has something for us. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some very old Pfizers, and I'm having a little bit of dieback on the tips here and there. And this isn't a new problem. This is the last couple of years. But I was wondering, can I cut those off, or am I better off just leaving it and not opening up the plant for any other disease?
And Pfizer, some people are probably going to, what are Pfizers?
Yeah. Yeah, the Pfizer juniper, P-F-I-T-Z-E-R, Pfizer junipers. That's an older cultivar of juniper. I think this is probably a Brian question.
Probably.
Is it Phomopsis, do you think?
Yeah, that would be my first guess when you have tip dieback, which is a fungal disease that we see very commonly. There are a couple of others that it could be, but my suggestion would be to go ahead and prune down about 4 inches below where you see dead tissue, 4 to 6, and then routinely decontaminate your pruning tools as you're cutting. Best of all possible worlds, you decontaminate between every cup, and I know a lot of people that's too much work, so definitely as routinely as you can, dip them in something like rubbing alcohol, so 70% alcohol. If you have a can of spray disinfectant, you can spray them until they drip and then allow them to air dry, and then that'll help make the shrub look a little bit better and get rid of this fungal pathogen. If it's there, you'll probably see the disease recur. The older varieties tend to be pretty susceptible to this particular disease. But if you're not seeing a lot at this point, I think you're doing very, very well, given how old that variety is.
Yeah. Thank you, Sue. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Louise in Platteville next. Hi, Louise.
Good morning. I was calling to mention the fact that I had the same thing happen that the gentleman with the beets had, where they were all snapped off or cut off.
Yeah.
Only mine was green beans. And they were up and looking, just looked so nice. And I went back to the garden, and all I had were just those two stems sticking up. But in my case, it was blackbirds.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Just gone down the road, just systematically, and everyone was gone.
Did they eat it, or did they leave the material sitting there?
No, it was gone.
Okay. All right.
It wasn't left there.
Yeah.
And I found out later that there was a big bush near the garden, a very large one. I have no idea what it was, but I found out later that there were several blackbird nests in that bush. And when I would be working in the garden, they would fly down like they were going to attack me. They really didn't want me there, that near their nest, but I didn't know that one in the first place. So. But anyway, it could be a bird, too, because that was my experience.
Well, thank you for calling, Louise. Appreciate your call. Yeah, you learn something new every day, don't you? Appreciate that call. Steve in Waterford, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a good garden this year. Everything's growing well. But my radishes, they seem to be about 6 to 8 inches tall, nice broad leaves, everything. But when you pull one out just to check every once in a while, there's nothing in the as far as a radish. And I'm worried that they're going to go into seed, and I'll get nothing but seeds. My question is, can you cut the tops off of the leaves and stunt the growth a little bit so it directs it toward the radish itself?
The problem with that isn't that you're cutting away the source of the leaves are what get the energy to grow the plant. And if you cut that away too much, you're going to have a problem.
Yeah. First of all, is this a variety that you've grown before?
Yes.
Okay. And they're not planted too close together, I take it?
No, I weeded them out, so they're about maybe an inch apart or so.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Fine.
And anything else changed since the last time that you grew this variety? Are you growing it in the same place, different place?
Well, I'm growing it in the same place, but this time I'm using mushroom compost.
Okay.
Might be a nitrogen issue.
That was my first thought, that you may have applied a lot of nitrogen, which tends to stimulate the plants to grow a lot of leaves rather than putting production into the roots.
Yeah. And I know there are also some micronutrient issues that can sometimes be a problem with the root crops. I'm not sure exactly what micronutrient, but I know that that sometimes can be an issue. If you've got really, really nice-looking tops and really skinny bottoms, that sounds like a
nitrogen issue.
Yeah.
Do the roots look healthy? Are they the appropriate color that you would expect?
Oh, yeah. They're white and with a little red elongated portion where the bulb is going to go.
Okay. So it doesn't sound like there are any disease issues involved.
No.
Yeah.
Or drainage or anything like that.
So you might want to get yourself a soil test just to take a look at the nitrogen, all of the nutrients that you have in your soil. Wouldn't hurt.
Is there a way to negate the nitrogen by putting something else in?
Not at this moment.
No. Nitrogen is fairly transient in the soil. It's still going to be there, though, for a while.
But next year it won't be as much.
Absolutely, yeah. Towards the end of the summer, it won't be as much. I don't really have any recommendations. The other thing, though, that I thought was when did you plant them at the usual time?
Well, I planted them in the middle of May, around the 15th or so.
Again, I'm kind of wondering about that hot spell that we had, whether that might have pushed a lot of top growth and not...
At the expense of the...
Right, the expense of the root formation. You know, radishes grow so fast, I would just reseed and see what you get. Of course, maybe not this weekend, because here in Madison, at least, we're going to be looking at 90 degrees, but you might want to try it, because usually it's about 22 days, and you might still be able to get some. And I know it's going to be getting hot pretty soon, but...
And I would do an experiment. I would reseed in the area where you're having problems and then reseed in another area where you have not applied the mushroom compost and see whether you see a difference.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And if it isn't successful because it gets too hot too fast, then try it again in late August and see what you get.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Tim in La Crosse.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
We've got a bunch of irises, and we're having horrible problems with the iris borer. When we pull out some of the bulbs, they're just mush. So is there anything we can do to eliminate them?
That's not fun. Brian can talk about the soft rot issue.
The mushy stuff.
Yeah, the mushy stuff. I can tell you the iris borer certainly is a big issue. There are some products that you can use. There's also some cultural things that you can do, like right after they bloom, you can cut them. You can cut them back, and the reason that you do that is that any eggs that have been laid or larvae that are on their way down through the leaves into the rhizome would be removed. Also, people make sure to cut back over the winter so that anybody who's overwintering there doesn't have the chance to do that. But there are there's an organic product, spinosad, that I can recommend. There's also the good old permethrin products. And when you buy a product, you need to look at the active ingredient to see what's in it. And you also need to look at the packaging to see whether the plant that you want to treat is in there. Now, in the case of iris, it might just say ornamental flowers. But it's something that you need to think about and be sure and follow all the label directions.
Mm-hmm. All right, there we go.
Yeah, and then...
For the soft rot issues, what is happening is not all of the damage is really due to the insect. It's coming in and then opening up wounds that allow in a bacterial pathogen that just basically digests all the pectin in those rhizomes. So that's all the glue that holds the cells together, and that's why they get so mushy.
And stinky.
Well, the stink is actually from secondary bacteria.
Oh, okay.
The bacterium that causes the soft rot does produce some compounds, but it isn't as stinky as other things that can move in afterwards.
Ah.
So, yeah, this is a big problem, not only on iris, but I love potato harvest time in the fall because we get rotten, stinky, disgusting potatoes in the lab. And nothing is worse than soft rot in cauliflower or broccoli.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a bad one. But if you can keep the insect out, then the soft rot typically won't get in unless you're wounding those rhizomes in some other way.
I don't think anything smells worse than a rotting potato.
Rotting broccoli and cauliflower.
They do?
Yes,
I'm sure
indeed.
Brian has had
I've
it.
Never had rotting broccoli
indeed.
And cauliflower.
I'm sure you have an open invitation to visit the lab. When
I heard a story one time, and I don't know whether this is true or it's kind of an urban legend, but it's a cool story nonetheless about an extension plant pathologist in California that was called out to a broccoli field to diagnose a disease problem, and it turned out to be soft rot, and they had to diagnose the problem with binoculars from the road because the stench was so bad.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, again, that may be an urban legend, but I think it makes a kind of nice story, and it certainly is. This disease is very, very stinky.
There we go. Well, Larry emailed to say his wife's black raspberry patch, about 80 plants, got orange rust fungus last year. She removed a bunch of plants and dug out the root ball, but it showed up again this year, and she's lost a few more. Anything she can do to stop the spread, Brian?
It depends on the rust, and I'd have to see a sample of that in the clinic or else have them send me some photographs. I might be able to tell from photographs because there's one particular rust on raspberries that goes systemic. And so with that one, you tend to get kind of bushy, broomed, yellowish-looking plants that are kind of stunted. Those you have to dig out and remove. Some of the other rusts on raspberries, the other one that I see particularly is an alternating rust, which I believe, unfortunately, the alternating host is white spruce.
Aww.
And there are lots of those out in the environment. So the spores coming off the white spruce are what are infecting the raspberries, and there are spores coming off the raspberries that infect the white spruce. So unless you're willing to get rid of your white spruce, that won't take care of the problem. But if you're seeing really stunty yellow plants that are kind of bushy with extra canes, then that's the systemic one where you do have to dig it up, and you may have to continue to dig like that for a while to get rid of any of the infections. That one does not alternate, as I recall. That one just reinfects raspberries.
Okay.
What about, do either of them overwinter in leaf litter at the raspberries?
The systemic one actually overwinters in the plants.
Yeah.
And so that's why you can't get rid of it. But again, because of the other rust is an alternating rust, even if you have leaf litter there, that's not what's causing problems on the rust plant.
Oh, because it's on the spruce.
The spores
right.
are coming from the spruce that infect the raspberries, and there's a spore on the raspberry that goes back and infects the root. So they bounce back and forth.
Oh, boy. There you go, Larry.
I love Russ. They're cool.
Larry doesn't.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Kate Menasha has a question, I bet. Hi, Kate.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hope this won't be too confusing. And I wonder if it's a situation based on the dry weather we've had in the Fox Valley. There's a lot of, it's hard to describe, fluffy. It looks like a fluffy spider web all over my plants in my shaded backyard. It's not in the sun. It's on the pine tree. It's even on the chain link fence. It's not cottonwood. It's not, the worm that infests trees.
Tent caterpillars?
Yeah, it's not that, because I've lived through that. And it's just all over. I wondered, is that a little spider? Is there anything that happens when it's dry?
Yeah, could be spider mite. It's a little early in the season, but I have seen a lot of mite damage on ornamental plants already. I've also seen a lot of lace bug on some things.
I had phlox that came in that was covered with mites. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah,
that's probably what it is, spider mites. When we don't have rain to wash the spider mites off, and particularly when we have hot, dry weather, they can just really go crazy. And they can reproduce very, very rapidly the warmer it is. So that is,
a possibility, certainly, of what might be going on.
Right, yeah.
And I would also mention that P.J. Leash is on next week, Wednesday, this coming week, Wednesday, on the show, and he may have some more to add to that as well, our insect diagnostic guy. So, Kate, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And Darlene in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Darlene.
Hi. I've got a question about a tiger lily. I had seen them blooming. It was sort of a wild one. And I dug it up and I transplanted it into my yard. And it comes up beautiful every year, and it's spreading beautifully. But when it gets ready to bloom, just before the bud is set, I believe. Yeah, or the bud is setting already. Yeah, okay. It starts to rot. And I've heard something about a blossom end rot, I believe. But I don't know if it's that. Any ideas?
Yeah, blossom end rot is a disease of tomatoes. It's actually a lack of calcium in the fruits that causes a rot of the bottom surface of the fruit. My thought, it could be something similar to that. I have seen calcium deficiencies in other plants cause problems. I'd be a little surprised if that were the issue, because other than things like tomatoes and other types of vegetables where the vegetable is actually a fruit like peppers and zucchini and other types of squash, they will get this blossom end rot. But I have on occasion seen that. But for the most part, we usually have enough calcium in our soil. The other thing it might be that we see on flowers, and I've not seen this on lilies before, but certainly on peonies and dahlias and roses, there's a disease called gray mold or botrytis blight. It's a fungal disease. And that particular pathogen is well adapted to infect flowers and flower buds. And it will oftentimes prevent flowers from opening, and they'll turn brown and die. So that could be what you're dealing with. The only way I'd be able to tell you for sure whether that's what it is would be if you sent a sample. I'd have to look for spores of the fungus in that dead tip to see whether that might be the cause of the problem. The other thing that I sometimes see cause flowers to abort like that would be if you have a low-grade root rot infection in the plants that can limit nutrient uptake and water uptake, and sometimes the top part of the plant will die back. But it sounds like those plants are pretty vigorously growing, so I'm a little bit doubtful about that. More inclined to think it might be this botrytis. What has it been relatively wet around the time when you see this bud die back?
No, not necessarily. But they were in an area, growing in an area that is pretty wet.
Okay, that could contribute to the problem, because botrytis likes it a little bit wetter. So we tend to see more problems with that fungus when we have rainy periods or in areas where there's more moisture.
I also know that wild tiger lilies, there is some kind of virus that they don't recommend putting it in your garden because it can infect your Asiatic and Oriental daylilies. That doesn't sound, though, like that kind of symptom. Do you see any like checkerboard yellow and green on the leaves or stunting of the plants?
There's nothing. This beautiful green, healthy, and yeah. I think waiting for that bloom to start, and oh.
Yeah. Huh.
I'm wondering if there are any potential insect issues that might go after the buds as well. I don't know about that as well. That would be another question for PJ.
Viroqua. There is that lily leaf beetle. I don't think we have found it in many places in the state. But you'd notice because they're these bright red little beetles, and they chew on the foliage. So I doubt that would be causing the issue. That's just a really weird one.
Yeah. Again, my first guess is gray mold.
Yeah.
Gray mold. All right. Thanks, Darlene. Appreciate the call. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, Brian Huddleston with Extension and Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. We have open lines at 800-642-1234. Give a call. We had an email from Cynthia who sent us a photo of a bush that's growing under a large old black walnut tree and wondering what it is. Lisa?
Well, unfortunately, it looks a whole lot like Multiflora rose, which is an invasive species, sorry to say. It's beautiful, but boy, it can definitely spread. And it does grow well even in shaded situations. I have seen photos of farm fields that are just, you know, totally devastated by this. So I would probably take that out. It does spread by seed as well as by root. Every time a cane hits the ground, it can root.
So get rid of it, Cynthia. Although it will grow under a black walnut,
yes,
apparently.
It certainly will.
Brian, I wanted to go back to the earlier caller. We didn't really talk about some control measures.
Yeah, if it truly is gray mold on that lily that the caller was talking about, there are some fungicide treatments if you're having chronic problems with this that you might want to consider. We do have a fact sheet on this particular disease, again, available at my website, again, in the fact sheet section. Just look under gray mold. And you'll find that. And again, this is useful not only for something like lilies, but also roses, any other sort of flowering plant, peonies that might have issues. And again, as Lisa pointed out, you need to make sure you get the right product. We list active ingredients in the fact sheet, and then also a product that's labeled for use on ornamentals.
All right. Dennis in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm calling for my wife because she couldn't call. Last fall, she was kind of redoing her gardens and did a lot of digging. And this spring, she's got weeds like she's never, ever, ever had before. It's just unbelievable. She thinks they're dormant seeds that have been resurrected from digging. Her question is, now what?
She's absolutely right.
Yep, she certainly is. So your strategies are going to depend on the types of weeds. If they are mostly annuals, those are a lot easier to get rid of than the perennials. Things like quackgrass and thistles are very, very difficult. You said this was a perennial garden or a vegetable garden?
Flowers, yes.
Flowers, yep. Okay. So, yeah, so a lot of heavy cultivation probably isn't going to be in the cards. And, of course, every time you cultivate, you do bring up more weed seed. So it's kind of a self-perpetuating issue, at least for a while. There's good old hand pulling. There are various herbicides that you can use. If this weren't a perennial garden, there would be some other things that you could do, like putting down, you know, cardboard and so on, and trying to smother the weeds that may not work in a perennial garden setting. But yeah, I've seen that happen before. Yeah.
Is there something you could do in the fall, perhaps? That I don't know.
Not really, not particularly.
And I would be very cautious given that it sounds like you have a perennial garden. If you decide to opt for herbicides,
those
can
careful.
Adversely affect the flowering plants that you want to keep around.
Right. If it's something like thistles, what you can do if you do want to go the chemical route, and I've certainly spent a lot of time pulling thistles to no avail, usually September, October, the perennial weeds are best at taking up herbicides. So what you can do is cut it down, and certainly don't let anything go to seed, perennial or annual, because then they outnumber you. I mean, they already do, but it's, you know, compounding the problem. But anyway, so what you can do is, you know, cut those down. You can even use a paintbrush to paint on something like Roundup or something like Garlon would be an option. That broadleaf control product, though, is not going to work on something like quackgrass. So it really depends on what your species are and how they're distributed in the garden. But yes, if you do use chemicals, be very, very careful.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn next to Monica in Pound, Wisconsin. Hi, Monica.
Hi. I have an amateurish question. I have what I think are rose beetles, but they're on my baby cherry and apple trees. I don't know how to get rid of them. I've been crushing them, but it's kind of time-consuming.
What do they look like?
Well, they're kind of tannish, and they have long legs, and they're always, almost always one on top of the other. They're in clusters.
Maybe rose chafer?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Let's see, where's mm-hmm. Pound? I'm sorry, I can't remember.
That's just about 20 miles west of Marinette.
Okay, so you're in a sandy soil. Yeah, that's probably what they are, is rose chafers. Do you have a fact sheet, don't
no,
you? Or
don't
is
have,
it at the learning store?
I think there must be one at the learning store.
I know I've
don't
seen
have.
One. Yeah, I would check at the learning store, and I would put in the search box rose chafer, C-H-A-F-E-R, and see if you can come up with something for that. It might be at this point in time in the season, you might have to use more of a contact product, but I don't know specifically what's
yeah.
recommended.
The other person you might want to call would Scott Royce. I know up in Marinette County, he's the ag horticulture educator up there. I know has talked about rose chafer before,
yeah.
So I know he has experience dealing with that. So you might just give the Marinette County UW Extension office a call and ask for him and see if he has some recommendations that he's given out to other people in the past.
Yeah, I know somebody, I can't remember her name, Door County?
Annie Deutsch.
Yes, Annie. Thank you. Sorry, Annie. Did a really nice presentation for the horticulture team last year because she, I believe, was having some issues with this. Yeah, it was either rose chafer or it was, there was another beetle. Anyway,
there's always
either
something.
One of them. Yeah. Yeah. That when they're in that sandy soil areas,
yeah.
You tend to have more problems.
But I know Scott has had experience with those
yeah.
in the past.
Try
so
Scott
he
first.
Probably has some recommendations he could give you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And Susan in Oconomowoc. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Thank you very much. I've got a question about my lilac bushes. I've heard multiple things about when to prune them. And I'll just tell you that I've tried pruning them right after they blossomed, and I told somebody said prune them later, somebody said, at any rate, for the last 4 years, I haven't gotten any lilacs until this year, and I got exactly 3 blooms. And so I want to know about pruning lilac bushes.
Okay. Well, whoever told you to prune them right after they flower, that is correct. They start to initiate flowers for next year within 2 or 3 weeks after they bloom. So you don't want to prune after 2 or 3 weeks after they bloom is probably too late. So getting that done pretty soon after blossom is recommended. I'm wondering, is your lilac in a lot of shade?
Yes, in total shade.
That's your problem. They don't bloom in shade, so pruning isn't unfortunately going to help you with that. Is it small enough that you can move it?
Oh, there's 3 of them, and they're a hedge type thing, but sounds like we're going to move it because I miss my flat.
Yeah. Unless you can prune the trees that are shading the lilacs.
Yes. When we first moved in, I don't think the trees were that big, and they were getting more sun, and we had beautiful lilacs.
Okay. Yep, that's the issue.
Definitely the issue. I thought for a moment if she'd been pruning everything down at the same time, you know, all of the branches down at once, she was going to have the problem. But the shade is really the...
Yeah, I killed a lilac that way.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I got shaded out.
Yeah.
Too big to move, and it's now dead.
And no place to put it.
No place to. I have no sun in my yard.
Yeah, I have a tiger eye sumac that has not only shaded itself, but the neighbor's maple is now shading it, and it's gorgeous and huge, and I'm going to have to take it out.
Chris and Adams called to say he was able to get rid of iris borer by digging up bulbs, soaking them in a mixture of 1 cup bleach with 1 gallon of water, let them dry, and replant.
Usually what happens is every year when the iris borer comes in, it usually is going to attack the iris when the leaves are like 4 to 6 inches tall. So it's something that happens every year. Kudos to you if it worked. But usually once they're inside the rhizome, you can't really get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, Lisa Johnson is one of our guests today. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator. She works out of Dane County, been a regular guest on the show for a long time, as has Brian Hoddleston. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County, and Brian Hoddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, here to answer your gardening questions. Lots of callers online. We'll go right to the phones and to Jan in Delafield. Jan, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question has to do with red twig dogwood bushes. I've got quite a few of them. They've always done very well. This year now, I've got this white sticky stuff. It looks like whipped cream, and it's attached to all the branches. I'm wondering what it is and how should I deal with it?
Spittle bugs, maybe?
That was my first thought also.
But sticky.
Sticky.
That's not sticky.
So does it look like little bubbles, like somebody spit on your plant?
Well, sort of. There's quite a lot of it. It's like each one of them is almost an inch long. They're not tiny little blobs. They're really quite big. And they're just, I haven't touched it, but it looks sticky. And it's just this sort of a foamy, sticky, white look, you know, of this stuff.
So it's not something like, it wouldn't be magnolia scale, but I'm wondering if it's some kind of soft-bodied scale.
Yeah.
Have you tried picking it apart? Does it come into pieces, or how does it?
Oh, I haven't touched it, but it definitely is soft. It's got to be some kind of soft consistency.
Do you have a digital camera by any chance? Why don't you take some photos and email those to me, and then I am suspicious that it's insect related, and I can get those photos onto PJ Leash, who's our insect diagnostician. But if you send an email to Hoddleston, Hudelson, at wisc.edu, I can take a look and see if it looks like a disease problem. I can't think of anything that might be disease related that would look like that on a...
It's more like spittle bug to me.
Yeah, or there's that, there's an aphid that's very...
Cottony
aphid. That could be it as well. But or if you have a camera on your phone, you can do that too.
Send some photos.
And Brian's email's also on his website if that's easier for you.
You'll find a slightly different one on the website, but I have like five and they mail go to the same mailbox. So use any and all.
All right. There we go. Thank you, Jan, for calling. Appreciate
your
call.
Yeah, I am too. I'll forward them to you, Lisa, as well.
By the way, Steve called to ask if there's a charge, you know, if somebody sends a plant or a disease, something or other, is there a charge for the diagnostic lab?
For most things, yes. It usually runs roughly $20 to $30 for most samples, depending on exactly what we have to do with it. There are certain diseases, though, that we will diagnose for free. So if you have questions, you're always welcome to call the lab and I can talk over what it would be. But if you have a tomato plant that's showing any sort of leaf spot or, quite frankly, having any problem, if you send that to us and invoke the words late blight, which is a disease we're very interested in, we'll do the diagnosis for free. We monitor for that disease because it has a big impact on our commercial potato production here in the state. And we want to know when it arrives in the state and what variant of that pathogen gets to Wisconsin. We also, if you have a boxwood that's got dieback, send it in, invoke the words boxwood blight, free diagnosis. That's a disease we have not seen in Wisconsin that can be very devastating to boxwood. It's been found in the Chicago area, so I think it's only a matter of time. And again, we want to catch that one early if it arrives in the state.
And in Jan's case, sending a photo, that's not going to be a charge.
No, there's no charge for that. Technically, we have a digital diagnosis charge on the books, but I never charge it because it's just, one, it's just lots of times I can't tell a lot from photos, and it's too difficult to try to track people down for money for that. So only for physical samples that come in.
All right, let's go to Margaret in La Crosse. Hi, Margaret.
Oh, thank you. Actually, this is not a plant pathology question. It's a question for Lisa. Is that okay?
Sure.
Oh, Lisa, I live in La Crosse. I garden with perennials on a ridge east of La Crosse, and I'm wondering, what new cultivars of coneflower are reliably hardy? I think La Crosse is still about a 4B zone.
Okay. Well, certainly our native, the Echinacea pallida, is going to be hardy in that area. Now, that's not a cultivar. That's the straight species. And the straight species of Echinacea purpurea should be. The problem with a lot of the new cultivars is that they have bred in a lot of different species of Echinacea, so a lot of them are western or southern species, and you just don't know what the parentage is. I can tell you that most of the ones that have orange or red in them are likely to be less hardy, and also the yellow varieties. And I've pretty much had to, we have our teaching garden at the Dane County office, and I've kind of used it as a trial ground to test some of these things. I buy one, I tend to, in my own personal garden, I buy something, and then I also try and get one for the teaching garden so that I at least have two. Very small sample size, but
yeah, better than one.
Yeah, it's better than one. So unfortunately, I don't have an absolute recommendation for you in terms of all the different purple and yellow and orange and red cultivars that are out there. But 4B, I guess I would stay away from red, orange, and yellow cultivars and stick to the purple. If you do want to try one of the red or orange, you know, just try one of them. Don't go whole hog and buy five.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Mike in De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hey, I've got on my viburnum, I've got a bug that I've just noticed today. It's a beetle. It's about 6-7 millimeters long. It's a dull, dark tan color, and it seems to be just feeding on the remnants of the blossoms.
It's not feeding on the foliage.
Well, I'm looking at the plant right now, and I've just seen one example where it looks like it might be on the foliage.
Okay. The reason that I ask is that there is a viburnum beetle, which has been pretty devastating. We've only seen it in the southeastern part of the state, you know, Milwaukee County and Kenosha Racine and so on. So I don't know of any reports from De Pere, but I would take a digital photo of it and shoot it right over to PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Lab just to be sure. Unfortunately, the, you know, dark tan is kind of, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that that would be, but I do know that that particular beetle is about the size that you're talking about, and so I'd want to get him to take a look at that.
So go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you just type that in, you're going to find that, and shoot a photo off to PJ Leash. There we go. Thanks so much, Mike. Jason in Cambridge, your turn. By the way, you can join in, too. We have open lines now. We'll get you a chance at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And now, Jason in Cambridge, what can we do for you?
Hi, yes. Hi, Larry. And yes, I had a question about gummy stem disease. I believe I have it in my garden, and I was curious as if it that was transferred in from some mulch that I had brought in, you know, if it does overwinter in the soil, and the best way to get rid of it.
Yeah, that one I believe can be brought in on seed, so that could be a potential source for that particular organism. It's a fungal disease. Actually, I hate to tell you this, but it's one of the cooler diseases that I see on pumpkin because of how it infects the fruits. You get these really cool concentric rings that form on the fruits as it's infected with little black lines that are actually rows of little fruiting bodies of the fungus. But I believe that can be seedborne. And so one of the things you could potentially consider would be some hot water seed treatments. We do have a fact sheet on that if you're interested in checking that out. Once you've had it, then my suggestion would be to definitely rotate. So move your vegetables, your pumpkins to another area in the garden. And this is just a good general practice whenever you're gardening is don't grow the same thing in the same place year after year because you will build up disease-causing organisms. And it's not necessarily in the soil per se, but it's in little leftover bits of plant debris that don't rot away right away. So most of the plant pathogens kind of disappear after a while if that old leaf or plant tissue rots away. So rotation oftentimes should take care of that. But that can be pretty devastating. It kind of goes into the stems. It can infect the fruits, can really cause devastation in a pumpkin crop.
All right, Jason, thank you. Appreciate your call. Kathy in Plover, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you. I was just on the phone speaking with your person in the back, so I missed just exactly what this disease is that you're talking about. But my question is about powdery mildew. Is that
okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. This is the first year that I've done any container gardening. I've always gardened in a big garden for the last couple of years for several reasons. I had to discontinue that. But I've got plants in containers. I've got tomatoes and peppers and some herbs. And I bought a squash. I have cucumbers, too. And I bought a squash plant. It's a yellow squash. And I noticed a couple of days after I planted it that it has powdery mildew. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what it is, white spots all over the leaves. Mm-hmm. So I kind of checked things out on the Internet, and I've been spraying it with baking soda and water on the tops and the bottoms of leaves to see if that would help, and I can't tell whether it's helping or not. What I've done now, and it had one little fruit on it about an inch and a half long, and that shriveled up and fell off, and the leaves are not doing so well. So I started cutting the leaves off and destroying them. There are still some little spots on the stem of the plant, but there are new leaves shooting up from the bottom. And I was wondering if I can still let that go, if maybe it'll be okay. And do I need to keep it separate from the rest of my pots? Because I don't know if that can be transmitted to other plants, you know, through by spores in the air.
Sure.
Or
or what else I can do to save this plant, or if it's best to get rid of it.
The cucurbits, that includes pumpkins and squash and all those sorts of plants, tend to be very, very susceptible to powdery mildew, and it's not a single disease. There are lots of powdery mildew fungi. It is a fungal disease. And the fungi that cause powdery mildews tend to be relatively host-specific. So if you have powdery mildew on your squash, you won't necessarily, it's not the same organism that's going to infect your phlox or your zinnias or any other plant that might be susceptible. Usually not. Again, these fungi tend to be host-specific. However, if you're seeing powdery mildew on one plant, that means that the environmental conditions are favorable for powdery mildews in general, which tends to indicate high humidity. So if your plants are densely packed together, or if we have really muggy weather, as we oftentimes do mid-season, that can be a very favorable environment for powdery mildews in general to develop. So oftentimes you'll see powdery mildew on a lot of plants at the same time, but it's not because it's the same fungus. In terms of the spray treatments that you're talking about, oftentimes when we recommend the baking soda treatment, it's in combination with some oil. So a paraffin-based oil, so a very lightweight horticultural oil. And sometimes I will recommend to folks, if you can't get a hold of that or you want to go more organic, you could use something like canola oil, which there is some research that indicates that there can be some anti-powdery mildew properties if you use that particular kind of oil. And it's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and 3 tablespoons of the lightweight horticultural oil in a gallon of water. And the unfortunate part is you saw symptoms and then tried to treat. That isn't usually successful. You need to get these products on new foliage before infection occurs. They prevent the fungus from getting into the plant. They will not cure existing infections. So you might want to try it if you're getting new leaves that are sprouting. Definitely you could try that treatment. Do be a little bit careful with the oil. Oftentimes when it's really hot, if you apply oils, it can be phytotoxic. So that means it'll burn the leaves. So you want to apply when it's relatively cool. And then the other thing, you know, I'm a little worried that you lost that fruit because I'm not sure that that would be due to powdery mildew. It might be, but there may be other things that are going on in your squash as well.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Thomas in Barnum, Minnesota emailed to say, balsam firs in the Duluth Superior area are having problems. Many middle-aged and older trees are dying rapidly. Many have splits in trunks. Orange needles work their way up the trunk in just a few months. Any idea what's happening there?
Could be a combination of things. The big one that I think of is probably winter injury or winter burn. Again, we had a bizarre winter this past winter, and if they did not have a lot of snow up in that area and had open areas where the ground got really cold, there may be root damage. If there wasn't a lot of rain going into the fall, the trees may not have had enough water stored internally to make it through the winter. We had a relatively long winter, so they need a lot of water just to take up and have internally to make it through the winter months. And I've seen a lot of winter burn across Wisconsin, and I'm expecting the same thing would be occurring in Minnesota. There are some diseases I have seen. There are some root rots that will destroy root tissue, and that will inhibit water uptake and, again, cause the plants to die. And then also up in the northern part of Wisconsin, and I would expect in Minnesota as well, there's a disease called armillaria root disease. It's a fungal disease. This particular fungus actually produces a mushroom. So if you see kind of honey-colored mushrooms around the base of these dying trees, that could be a contributor as well. That tends to kill the trees off too.
And then once you get the disease, then the insects move in.
Yeah, once the trees are stressed, then a lot of those trees are going to be visited by insects that, if the tree doesn't die from the disease, the insects will finish it off.
And Thomas was seeing lots of woodpecker holes near the base of those many of those trees, and that's just what's happening for sure. Allison emailed to say she planted some sweet corn, growing great, but she planted them 4 inches apart. She's heard it's supposed to she's supposed to thin them, but she doesn't see farmers thinning their fields. Could you clear this up for her? Well, 4 inches is...
That's pretty close.
Yeah. And the planters, the corn planters that farmers use, the planting is done at a... I'm not sure the distance apart, but it's a very controlled process of planting those corn plants.
Yeah, corn, I mean, it gets pretty big, so that sounds really close to me. I got to admit, I'm not an agronomic crop person, but that sounds
what I'd
close.
Probably do is I'd on one end, I'd probably maybe leave them, and in another spot, I'd take every other one out.
Well, you could do an experiment that
and
way.
And just
yeah.
do a little experiment to see how close. But I'm just not sure right off the top of my head what the spacing is for those. But that'd be a good experiment to try anyway. I was doing my 3-mile jog through the neighborhood, and there's one neighbor a few blocks over that I've got to stop. I go by too early, I think, for that person to be up. But they planted their tomato. They've got this beautiful-looking little bed in front of the house, and they've got probably 8 tomato plants, and they're planted a foot apart.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, ow.
A foot apart.
Wow.
Yeah, great for leaf diseases. And just to let you know, and the common one is septoria leaf spot. It'll defoliate from the bottom up, and I had my first case of septoria leaf spot coming to the clinic this week from up in the River Falls area. So that fungus is active.
Bill in Knife River called to say he believes that, just back to the rhubarb flower stalks, they're all hollow for the entire length. Is that true?
They mentioned, the caller had mentioned that the stalks were hollow, but I don't know about the whole length.
I am not sure of that either. So I'm not sure about that myself.
I've cut them back, and I don't remember whether that's something that's normal or not.
Somebody wondered about your favorite way to enjoy summer melons.
Who were they addressing that question to?
I think any of us. If I've got melons, watermelons or muskmelons, I don't do a whole lot with them, but
I just
eat them the way they are.
Yeah.
Although I do enjoy, there we go. The person who sent a photo in with some muskmelon, and draped over the muskmelon I don't know if it's not ham, but something, a very thinly sliced meat over the top.
Huh.
I'm not sure.
I've heard of that, but I can't remember what it is. Yeah.
And the other way I like muskmelon is with a big scoop of vanilla ice cream.
That sounds very good.
Oh, wow. I like it with blueberries, because you have the sour and the sweet.
Oh, blueberries. I've never tried blueberries.
Yeah, I like, you can make a red, white, and blue salad with, watermelon and blueberries, and then a little bit of, cream.
Or probably ice cream.
Yeah, that works too.
All right, there we go. Well, what, anything in the last 30 seconds or so, what can we expect in the way of disease down the road here in
the
next
month?
All I
can say is lots and lots of everything, given the rain pattern that we've had. I am expecting to see everything under the sun in the clinics. So watch for leaf diseases, root rot diseases, everything.
And winter burn.
And winter burn. More yeah, winter burn. We're getting lots of photos of evergreens that are all brown.
Toasty
and
evergreens.
Yeah, toasty evergreens and bushes that are the result of winter burn, pretty much. Well, thank you guys so much for being with us, and you'll come back and be with us again,
yeah,
I assume.
Thanks, Larry. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you.
Right.
Lisa Johnson, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. They'll be back. We'll do it again. Next week, one of the vicars of vegetables, Jim Nienhuis, will talk about his new pepper cultivar that won some big prize. So we'll hear about that. And on Monday at this time, our physical therapist will be back to talk about ACL injuries and to take your questions. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.